And so we're into the second half of Series 1 of Sport and the Fields in association with Aldi UK, official supermarket partner of Team GB. I'm Jonathan Overend, bringing together some of the UK's most familiar sporting voices to share some of our stories from the front row of sports reporting over the years, watching some historic moments, talking to some remarkable people. It seems a perfect moment to remind you to subscribe if you haven't already. The 8 episodes so far have included Claire Balding, Catherine Merry, Jeanette Kwachi, Ian Dark, Gary Hall from Taekwondo, Ben Ryan from the Fiji Rugby Sevens team. What a story that was last time out. And on this episode, we really do have a British Olympic legend. And we're going to be talking about many Olympic Games because he went to a lot, he won at a lot. But I suppose we're primarily talking about Sydney 2000 because that's really where his story and the story of a rather close friend of his really came to a head. We've got Mark Pugach back on the pod because that was your first, wasn't it? How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Jonathan. And I love talking about the Sydney Olympics. It was my first Summer Games and it was just off the scale exciting. And of course, from our point of view, working there, we're going to the Olympics, Britain had won one gold medal. Youngsters, yes, there were days where Britain really weren't very good at the Olympics. One gold medal in 96, which was Steve Redgrave and Matt Pinson. So we go to Sydney, and the story is if Redgrave wins, he wins an unprecedented fifth gold medal, unprecedented for a British athlete. And that's what all the story was. And of course, you're in Australia. They're not going to give you anything. Certainly the local media aren't going to talk up anything to do with Britain because they're extremely one-eyed. But that was, I remember very much as we arrived in Sydney, that was the big story in town. Would Redgrave do it? Could Pinsent do it with him again?
Yep, that was the thing, wasn't it? Steve Redgrave had won his third gold medal in Barcelona, 92, with a very young Matt Pinsent, and then had won his fourth gold medal in Atlanta 96, well, with a slightly older Matt Pinson, but of course famously had said after that that you could shoot him if he ever got in a boat again. Well, back he came, and in 2000 in Sydney, Pinson was going for his third, remarkable, but Redgrave was going for his fifth, utterly astonishing. It's that idea of the teammate, isn't it, Mark, that we want to explore in this episode. That's what we're calling this edition. How do you work together as a team, whether it's a two-person team or more, to fulfil everybody's dream at the same time?
Well, because they're in a coxless four also for the first time, rather than just the two of them. So James Cracknell and Tim Foster were in there as well. But all of us, and the media and the watching public, you know, all the focus was really on one man, wasn't it? Steve Redgrave. And nobody knew him better by then than Matt Pinsent.
Well, Mark, this is exciting, isn't it? First time we've had a Knight of the Realm on this series of the pod. So, Matt Pinsent, how are you?
Very good, thank you.
Good. There must be one friend, maybe from Oxford days, that you have the running gag with, isn't there? That you insist on being called Sir to them.
There are loads of people I insist on. You know, mainly children and wife, that sort of thing. I'm already in trouble now.
But generally, what's your view? I mean, I know Andy Murray's attitude is I really do not want to live my life being known as Sir. Are you kind of the same?
No, I'm sort of the same. I was told fairly early on, and it's sort of true, that it basically all you do is you change Mr. to Sir. You know, when in normal life do you use Mr.? It's only on the most formal things, sort of bank statements or, you know, formal things dropping through the letterbox, which is a sort of dying art anyway. I definitely don't have it on the bank cards. The bank gave me that option. And I was like, look, I just don't want to be standing in the petrol station handing over a credit card with Sir written on it. It's just not, you know. And so actually, it really is very seldom that it comes up. And then actually, it trips up far more people because they say, oh, how do you want to be referred to? And I'm like, well, either Matt or Matthew is fine. I use those interchangeably.
Brilliant. That's brilliant. You give them that one. So much of your career obviously was spent right next to Steve Redgrave, so many of your great moments. Can you remember the very first time you sat in a boat with him?
Yes, because, I mean, I was soon after leaving school, so I went to Henley to sort of pursue the rowing dream. joined a club near the bridge there called Leander, which, you know, had a huge track record of producing gold medalists and internationals from the sport. We were training along as sort of late teenagers, sort of early 20s, a group of young aspiring people. And then back in the late autumn, back from Seoul Olympics, 88, came the group of guys who'd been to the games. And suddenly we were then being raced off against one another and training in the gym at the same time and on occasion going out in boats. And it was, yeah, it was always a big moment thinking, right, I'm in a boat. It might be in an 8-man or 4-man boat. You know, I'm in a boat with Steve Redgrave. It was always a thrill. But then that acceleration from just one of the squad to then being his pair's partner, it probably took, you know, a year, probably slightly more. But even then, as Steve, you sort of, you know, says through gritted teeth, he hated the headline when it said that Redgrave rose in a pair with teenager, you know, and I was sort of late 19 before... But as I was stepping into a boat in a pair with him, which is a very different kettle of fish. If you're in a group, if you're in an 8, if you're in a 4, there's a sort of, you know, there's a repartee and a sort of dialogue that's just going on. There's just chatter all the time. Whereas in a pair, it is so much more, well, intimate, and I use the word, you know, advisedly. You are a partnership in the literal sense.
Mm. Before then, you'd won the World Junior Championships, hadn't you? Actually, with Tim Foster, who yes. We'll talk about a little later. That was 1988, so you would have been at Oxford at that time, I'm guessing.
Just
then,
at,
if you cast
yeah,
your mind back
school,
before the Leander days, was your heart set on a lifetime in rowing, or were you pursuing the academic side?
The wonderful thing about rowing is you can do them both at the same time. Mm. And that's lots of people advise me, look, just don't put all your eggs in one basket. As much as you want to row, as much as you think that you can, you know, get to the Olympics or whatever. I mean, I don't think anyone would have used the word career around Olympic or rowing sport at that stage. But there was definitely a push from school coaches, from my parents, from people I rode with, just to say, look, just don't give it all up because you know, rowing might go wrong, you know. And the idea of core, I mean, rowing is sort of, you know, Oxford won't like to say it, but it's embedded in the culture of Oxbridge, and the boat race is a very worthy ambition as a, you know, 19, 20 year old oarsman and woman. And so, you know, I was able to run it at the same time, and that's a massive advantage actually in rowing.
But when you were confirmed in the boat with Steve Redgrave, we're talking about a man who's already won 2 Olympic gold medals, and you're a teenager. Yeah. How yeah. intimidating was that? Just the two of you?
Yes, pretty high on the intimidation scale.
What were those early chats like?
Yeah. Well, who are you, just, young man?
Yeah, yeah, sort of. It was a sort of, but actually, right from the beginning, we spoke very candidly and openly and honestly to one another about what we wanted to achieve. And it was a pretty simple mission statement of, we want to go to the Olympics and win a gold medal. And for him, of course, it was another gold medal. But really, he didn't bring his gold medals, you know, in a literal sense, because he knew that he could sort of crush my spirit if he was too domineering. And I realized, look, if I'm just a sort of wallflower here, it's just not what he needs. It's not what's gonna make me. I've just got to, you know, sort of puff my chest out and just give it everything, because if it's going to go wrong, I'd much prefer to look back on it and think it didn't go well, I had my chance but it didn't work out and I gave it absolutely everything, than look back and think, god, I was just so scared.
So did you need to challenge him?
Yes, I think I did. Well, whether I needed to or not, but that's the route I took. And so we just competed at everything. We competed in the gym. We competed on the rowing machine. We competed at weights. We competed, you know, almost the very first rowing session I had in a pair with him. And the selectors were cycling up and down the towpath, sort of watching our first thing. And it was just a sort of gentle, we weren't trying to do a race speed or something. And just as we came back to the the boathouse, I said, come on, let's just do 10 strokes where we absolutely go flat out, and let's just see what we do, just like this, just rough and ready as it is. We've done no training together, no mileage on the clock. Let's go for it. And we absolutely lamped it for about three of the four strokes. And we had to stop because he was pulling the boat round. So it basically did a right angle in the river.
And, wait, are you saying he was stronger, Matt?
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. I was like, I was just absolutely mouth open. I just couldn't believe the power that he was generating and the effect that it was having on the boat. And after four or five strokes, I said, whoa, 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 we're about to hit the bank. And the coaches were like, what the hell's going on here? And he turned around and went, you know, is that enough? And I was like, I think it probably is. And then he did a little sort of Redgrave smile, and he said, you've always got to ask yourself, who's got the rudder? And all he did was just steer massively against me using the rudder. And he totally, totally fooled me with it. I just thought, oh my God, I'm never going to be able to keep up with him. But he just stitched me up brilliantly. But it was, and that was the way we started. It was sort of taking the mick out of each other and winding each other up and competing. And the way we rationalized it was we hone our skills against one another, so that when we turn them against the rest of the world, we are that much hungrier because we just want to win all the time. And that was sort of our, you know, that was sort of our raison d'etre, really.
I've heard from a lot of people, Matt. Roy Keane has said this to me, that training at Manchester United during the week was so ferociously hard, so that the game on the Saturday was frankly really straightforward. Are you saying it was a bit like that? You train so hard against each other, trying to prove something against each other, that come race day, obviously not every time, but more often than not, the race actually was a lot simpler than the training.
I think there's a lot to that. I think we trained very hard. You know, there's lots of stuff coming out in sport, and particularly around elite sport and Olympic sport in this country and other places, where that culture comes with some really unpleasant tags, you know, let's be honest. And we never tipped over into that. We never tipped over into, it was competitive, but it was never, well, there's no other word for it, abusive. There are some of these cultures that were abuse, that are abusive. And it was never like that with us, with our, within that club or within that team. It was hard-nosed, but there was always a twinkle in the eye. Everybody knew what was going on. And on rowing machines, you know, or in the weights room, there's just no hiding it, because you can see everybody's scores. You can see what the physical requirements are. And it just would become, you know, and later on, I mean, it was only a year later when Jürgen, our coach, joined us, you know, part of his job was actually sort of cooling that competitive physical side down a bit, because otherwise we might have overtrained. We might have pushed too hard against one another or the other guys in the squad or whatever. And we wanted to make sure that we were going to have, you know, a really long season or a long career. And the last thing you want is pushing yourself to the max in, you know, November or March or something, and suddenly find you're in no fit state to race in July.
You're a team, aren't you? And you have to be a team almost unlike any other sport. If someone is slightly out, that's it. It's all gone.
Yeah.
How hard has that been with all the different people you've rode with over the course of your career to maintain that level? That, and what is it about the companionship, the teammate, that excuse me, the team spirit, whether it be a two, a four, or even more, that allows you to develop that sync, that all-important sync? What is it?
I mean, that is so ingrained in rowing, it's very difficult now to tease out, well, exactly what made us good at it. You know, ultimately, if you spend hours and hours and days and months and years together honing that skill, and you get very good at sort of reading the boat. Yes, you're a team, and yes, you're sitting in different parts of that boat, but you're joined together by a very responsive, stiff piece of plastic, which not only is going to sort of steer left and right on the river, depending on who's pulling harder, but it's also going to tip backwards and forwards. So you've got all this power going in, driving the boat through the water. But then the other part of the rowing stroke is you know, what is literally we call the recovery, as you sort of slide forward and you gather forward for the next stroke. So you're not, it's not 100% work, it's not 100% effort all the time, and you've got this contrast of power, the impulse, and then the relaxation. And that bit, you've still got to be timed altogether. And we would do drill after drill after drill to make sure that we were totally in sync. And it got to the stage, you know, Steve and I were in the pair for 5 years, 6 years. It got to the stage where we didn't have to say anything at 8:15 in the morning as we pushed off, you know, the landing stage and out into the river. We could just feel it. We could just feel whether someone was tired or hungover or argumentative, because the boat is doing all sorts of talking without you saying a thing. And that skill, that communication then carries through to an Olympic race where you've got 2,000 metres. It's going to take you, what's in a pair? It's 6.5 minutes, a little under. And everything's got to be absolutely lined up. And when you're, you know, at Olympic level, you then are putting all of your energy into 6.5 minutes sort of explosion, and it's got to be all lined up, because if there's a misfire at that point, you're just not going to win. You're not going to do it.
This is Sport in the Fields in association with Aldi UK, official supermarket partner of Team GB. We're in conversation with Sir Matthew Pinsent, who, along with Tim Foster, James Cracknell and Steve Redgrave, arrived at the lake in Sydney on the 23rd of September 2000, going for history. Could they feel it?
Oh, we knew it, because we were racing. Rowing is normally in the morning. I think we were last of that morning's final, so we were racing around 11 or 11.30, something like that. But in order to be your physical peak at 11 in the morning, we were living a routine where we were getting out of bed at 4.35 in the morning in the Olympic Village, and then rattling out to Penrith on one of the coaches. And then we'd get off the bus and we'd go for what we'd call a warm-up outing. It was just a sort of gentle loosener out on the lake. But this, you know, it would be sort of first light. I think it was like 6:30, 6:45, something like that. I mean, beautiful, lovely and cool and calm. And we're just going out, very quiet. We just go out and do a lap. And as we came down the lake for the last time, you know, just about to paddle into the boathouses and wait out the few hours for the final, the massive empty grandstands. And then suddenly it's like, come on, Britain. And you look up, and there's dozens of British fans attaching Union Jacks to the railings and grabbing the best seats on the finish line. And you think, oh my God, like, they've got out of bed at 4 a.m. to be there. Yeah. That's the, you know, this race is why they are there. And that got all of us. All of us heard it. You know, there's no joke you can say at that point which is going to break that mood, because there's just no escaping it. And that run into, you know, 4 or 5 hours before you race or whatever. Yeah, 4 hours before you race is just horrendous. You're going through a sort of maelstrom of emotion about, you know, this is the most important day of my life. And you have to believe that in order to perform at gold medal level.
Did it feel horrendous, even more important, though, than the other ones because of what Steve Redgrave was potentially about to achieve?
I think we knew it. Of course we knew it. We knew it was a huge story. We knew desperately that he didn't want to finish his career on anything other than a gold. By that point, you know, I'd got 2 gold medals under my belt, so I wasn't interested in winning a silver or a bronze. And James Cracknell and Tim Foster, okay, they'd been to an Olympics before. Tim had won a bronze in Atlanta, but this was their moment too. And so we all had our stories and our different strands to get to that moment. And it just had to go right. And the advantage in rowing, I suppose, is you've got a week where you're competing, you've got the heat, you've got the semi-final, and both of those have gone really well. And we sort of knew it was ours to lose. I mean, I'm hesitating to say that, but we were certainly favourites. We were certainly favourites. And if we had lost at that moment, it would have, you know, sort of come crashing down on us, because, you know, Steve himself, I mean, people used to come and watch us train and come and interview us all. But really what they wanted to do was talk to Steve. And the only question they wanted to ask Steve was, are you going to win in Sydney? And all he had to say for 5 or 4 years was, yes, we're going to win. You know, I mean, it was just a sort of...
That's a huge pressure.
I know. But there's you know, in the Olympics, there's no way around that. For what is a little sport like rowing, the only thing that people really measure their career by is an Olympics. And those only come along every 4 years. And so it's... That's what makes it magical, is that, you know, golfers and tennis players and premiership footballers and everyone, if it goes wrong, they've got something else coming down the pipe quite soon, you know, sometimes next weekend. Whereas for us, if that had gone wrong, you've got a 4 year wait to put it right, or it's well, thanks and goodbye.
Matt, did you
not say to him, though, the first time he got back in the boat, I thought you weren't getting back in a boat. I thought I was supposed to shoot you now. Because just to remind everybody, he famously said, didn't he, in 96, if you see me near a boat again, shoot me. After you two had won the only gold medal Britain won in 96, which is another story altogether.
A classic. I mean, back then, Olympics were proper. They didn't hand out gold medals willy-nilly. You really had to earn them. Look, his retirement, it probably only lasted 2 weeks, 3 weeks, but it was another 6 or 7 before he and I had a conversation. And then I reckon it was another 3 or 4 weeks before he told his wife, you know. I just think I've never really unpicked with him why he needed to go on. I think Atlanta was a really... In lots of ways, it was a very negative experience, a sort of downbeat. You know, look at our reactions. Him saying, that's it, I'm out, you know, I'm done, I'm relieved, I'm gone. You know, it's just like, it wasn't the sort of classic retirement speech. And I think in time, he just thought, oh, you know, that's just, maybe I've got one more left in me.
And just a last one on that 2000 gold. Yes, you were favourites. Yes, you had a healthy lead. But goodness me, another 50 metres and you might have lost because those Italians were closing, weren't there?
Well,
and the interesting thing about... Yeah, OK, all right, you had it in the bag.
I think you've overstepped your mark Jonathan.
You were looking around, Matt.
You were looking
a little worried.
Yeah. They were clawing back at us. But there was a sort of gritty element, or certainly was in my head, which is they are never going to get past us. There is no way we're going to let them past us. There just isn't. But there were all sorts of things wrong with that race, you know. And our coach was, I mean, once the initial cloud nine thing of winning, he was really disappointed. He was sort of like, you know, how could you be leading by a second and a half at halfway and only win by 0.4 or whatever it was. He was sort of, you know, we've got to put that right.
I love that reaction. Sir Alex Ferguson famously did it once after Aberdeen won the Scottish Cup final and was interviewed, and he just basically slagged his team off, who just won the cup. Okay, that wasn't good enough. Didn't play very well. I love that attitude from you guys. Well, we won, but really wasn't very good.
There's part of sport which is what the psychologists call, they talk about process, not product. Because you concentrate on what you want to happen in your own head, in your own team, your own tactics. You've got your plan. And then you go out and try and execute is the word that everyone uses. You go and execute your plan. And if you do your plan and lose, that's one level of discussion. But if you don't do your plan, that's a whole other. And so, you know, in our coach's mind, we got minus points that day for actually not executing our plan as well as we possibly could.
Oh, you went off script a bit, did you?
Well, if you're leading by a second and a half at halfway and using all the energy to get out and lead that race, you should be then controlling it. It's sort of like being, I don't know, whatever the tennis equivalent is. You're 4-1 up and it goes to a tie break. It's like, no, it shouldn't be like that. You just close the set out. It's part of the discipline of getting to that level. If you're a second and a half up, you shouldn't let them back in the race. And he was quietly fuming about that. It took him a few months to tell me, but he was fuming.
Jonathan, we've talked about this before, which is that when you're lucky enough to be at the Games, and I was there, the way that the local media reported. So we, working at the BBC, obviously, this is what the story was. I remember watching it in the flat we were staying in Sydney. And already by then, we'd clocked what the Aussies were like. So I'm thinking, how are they going to commentate on this? And I forgive me, Matt, I think the Aussies were in the final. They may not have
been.
They were.
But they were.
Okay, so yeah. I want to say they said it was Channel 7, I think. They said something like, the Aussies have come fifth. Oh, Redgrave's won. You know, it felt like that. It really felt... Because obviously, I couldn't hear the commentary because I was shouting so much at the television. But it really felt like that, that their sort of one-eyed commentary told us, first of all, where the Australian boat had finished, and then sort of went, oh, one on the Brits, one on Redgrave. You did it. Yeah, get on
but
with it.
But that's... I mean, I... Yeah, going to their Olympics and, you know... them being generous to anybody else is yeah. It's going to be hard going. You know, it is going to be hard going. It's supposed to be their party. But I do remember there was the New Zealand boat in that race as well. And one of their dads came up to us afterwards and said, look, my son was in that race. And if he couldn't win, then I'm really glad it was you. And I thought, do you know what? That is a lovely way of putting it, sort of charming. And that spoke volumes.
I'm sure the Aussies felt the same.
Oh, the athletes have always been lovely. The media, you're never gonna get a clap on back from the Sydney Morning Herald or whoever.
I know, absolutely.
And I bet that was a good night, wasn't it, Matt?
Oh, what we made a mistake, and that was another mistake we made that day, is that you guys know what the media scrum is like. You go from a live interview, what feels like, you know, well, it was right before the medal ceremony, to then you go to the media tent afterwards. To then you have a separate press. Oh, we want the Sundays as well because this was a Saturday and the deadline. Da 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 da. So the Sunday papers need a thing. And so can we have some one-on-ones? This is all at the lake. Yeah. And then you get in a minivan and you're heading down to the media centre because we were out in Penrith. And then you go around and so all of a sudden we were on the BBC studio on the sort of couch with Sue, I think, Sue Barker. And she said, her first question was, well, guys, you know, it's been 7 hours since you won. You know, how do you look back on it? And we just thought, what? 7 hours? And this went on once BBC back in the media village got first dibs, and it went on and on and on and on after that. And for Steve, longer still. So actually, by the time we finished all that and everyone said, right, we're done, we all wanted to go and find our wives and girlfriends and children and parents who were all scattered across Sydney in different places. So actually... But we sort of shook hands that night. We shook hands and said, right, you know, see you tomorrow down at the lake to watch the second bit of the finals. But we definitely didn't go out. And that's something I definitely put right for Athens 4 years later. I learned my lesson because it really missed it. I really missed it.
Athens is the final. Well, it's your, to Steve Redgrave, Sydney, Athens was your swan song at Olympic level, wasn't it? And a fourth, amazing fourth gold medal with Cracknell, Williams and Code. Yeah. And it must have been so special for you, Matt, because of what had happened in your personal life at that time.
So I'd got married by then to Demetra, who's Greek-Canadian. So there was quite a few sort of emotional circles going on with the fact that I had Greek cousins who were, you know, coming to support me at an Athens Olympics. I had in-laws coming across the Atlantic from Canada, and we ended up, you know, sort of having a showdown with Canada in that race, and a wife who, you know, promised she just wanted me to win. It was, of course, there could be no other tug on her heart in any other direction. The real impetus was, of course, it was an Olympic final or Olympic campaign without Steve, and that was so different.
Were you team leader inevitably? Did everyone look to you to be team leader?
Ooh. Yes, I mean, de facto, I was. I mean, if I'm being harsh, I probably wasn't a good enough leader to really, you know, James shouldered some of that too, because James is almost more confident and such a gobbier than I am. And I just think you need someone like that, particularly, you know, with people, because he could remember what it was like being involved in a unit where it was his first Olympics. It was his chance to win a gold. So I think he was a real asset that Steve Williams and Ed Code lent on in a way that that I probably didn't offer in a funny way with retrospect. I just felt my role was, look, I'm the stroke man. I just need to do my thing. I just need to shut up and row, which is fine. But actually, I probably, looking back, I probably could have been more vocal. I could have been more, you know, Henry V in the crew room before we went out.
I like that. Henry V. Brilliant. Great. What a life. What a lifetime. What a career. And, you know, I don't know if you get fed up with talking about it, but I don't think I would. You know, is there one thing that stands out when you reflect on your Olympic life as a whole, Matt, in terms of how it's sort of shaped you as a person?
Well, there are many things. There are hundreds of things. Yeah. But I think the hindsight, you re-examine everything. And what's fascinating and in some ways horrifying, and I've touched on this before, is that some of the trappings of that life of elite sport are now being surrounded by, goodness, what an unhealthy atmosphere that is, and that shouldn't be encouraged. And that really makes me stop and think, blimey, you know, some people finish their Olympic career and have real issues with it. And of course, the reality is loads of people do for a whole variety of reasons. And so the sort of final blessing of my career is that I never for a moment look back and think we could have been nicer to one another, or we could have got on better, or I've got regrets about what we did.
Matt, can I ask, has the Michael Jordan documentary brought that into sharper focus?
Well, there's that. There's also all the stuff around gymnastics, both in the US and the UK now. There are other Olympic sports and the funding question in GB at the moment. But yeah, I mean, loads of people watch that Jordan documentary and go, wow, what a winner. And I go, wow, what a bully. I would have hated to have trained in a team with a character like that.
But Matt, if I play devil's advocates, others who were the stars of the team went, wow, bully, but I've got a winner's medal because of him. Do you know what I mean? So where's the balance in there?
Well, but then I ask, you know, do you need to be a bully to do that? And I thought it was fascinating. There's one bit where it's the only bit that makes him say, can we take a pause, is where they talk about, Are your teammates your best friends, or a question equivalent to that? And he can't answer it. And there are loads of shots of him, you know, before massive games, and he's playing sort of flick a coin across the floor with his security guards for money. And you think, what? You're just about to play an NBA championship, and you're not with your team. It just, that was like, I thought, what on earth is going on? Like, what sort of pressure was he under? What sort of pressure, you know, did he put other people under? What power did he have? Did he abuse that power? What was the training environment like? It was, you know, did he have hiring and firing over other players? Just extraordinary. It stopped me in my tracks there. And I just thought, wow, you know, so when people talk about, oh, you know, you guys are determined and you had an unbelievable desire to win. And I'm like, yeah, I'm happy to take all that. But I need to have a rider that we have no regrets now. We you know, we're godparents to each other's children and go to weddings. And, you know, it's we're all good with that.
And that's as important to you as winning the gold medals, obviously, judging by what you're saying.
Wow.
The manner in which you did it and the way in which you behaved.
I just think maybe we're entering a period now with Olympics and the Olympic team and Team GB where all sorts of questions are going to be asked. And that's fine. I'm totally up for that discussion and all those articles being written. I'm happy to be part of it. I'm part of that media. I get to ask these guys what it's like when they finish as well. But I definitely, you know, we have no skeletons in the closet in that regard at all. We loved our sport, and that's absolutely, and I left it with no regrets whatsoever. I've never regretted the timing of stopping or the competitiveness or the competitions that we had in and outside that squad. It was a wonderful time. And if I had my time again, I'd do it all over again in a heartbeat.
Matt, thanks so much for taking the time, taking up a lot of your time. Really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Absolute
for coming
pleasure.
On.
Matt, I've got one more question, which is a really important one.
Go on.
Who's a better golfer, you or Steve Redgrave?
We always pay for huge money and never pay our debts. So we play a two ball and it's like, all right, going to play £1,000 a hole. Righto, you know. Yeah. And then you're putting on the 18th. This is for 18 grand or, you know, this is for 6 grand or something. And then we shake hands and never, you know, buy each other a drink. Yeah. It's he's been a lot better than me for a lot of the time. And then the last 4 or 5 years, I've been edging him and it's been lovely.
So there we go, Sir Matt Pinsent on the pod. Fascinating on so many levels, but Mark, wasn't that really interesting stuff towards the end there? And I was thinking as he was speaking, you know, let's not kid ourselves, rowing has not been immune from this sort of conversation over the years, but Matt making it absolutely clear, I thought, from his point of view, nothing untoward he had ever seen. Certainly his teammates, whether it be in a pair or in a four, were always the best of friends. But in other sports, he has seen it. He's seen it going on and he's concerned about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think because of lockdown, if you have any vague interest in sports, you've probably, and you've got access to Netflix, you've watched the Michael Jordan documentary over the last 4 months. And I don't know anything about basketball, but I was absolutely fascinated by it because of the relationship that Jordan had with his teammates. And I am watching it a lot and thinking, is this acceptable? Is this being pushed too far? If I felt I was being pushed too far, would I get my NBA medal or ring or whatever they have out of my pocket and go, well, it was probably worth it because I would not have had one of these without the man that many say is the greatest basketball player that's ever lived. So really, it's such a fascinating debate for someone like Matt, who has been on the inside of it and all the success that he's had, to say, as much as I'm excited about what I've done, I can look back and know that we did it in the right manner. I think that's really significant.
Indeed. Thank you, Mark. We were listing some of Essex's sporting greats, weren't we, last time you were on? I've thought of a few more. Don't forget Ronnie Irani from the cricket. And Eamon Martin. Remember him?
Oh, the marathon runner.
Yes. Long distance runner from
Basel. Absolutely.
There was a squash player as well.
Yes.
His name will come to me in a minute.
Oh, what about Rod Harrington, the dance player?
Yeah, Rod Harrington. We loved a bit of Rod.
Lived in Boreham.
No, he was great fun.
Near Chelmsford.
Yes.
Chris Walker. Chris Walker, that was him, the squash champion. He was from Colchester. I mean, basically, we'd claim anybody, wouldn't we? Even if they'd just been on a day trip to Clacton.
Well, we're also very, very good at just sort of wending our way into metropolitan East London, weren't we? And going, well, Chingford, yes. Chigwell, East Ilford, that's definitely Essex. Don't worry about the postcode. Yeah, we'll have them.
Well, they used to call it from the coast to the capital in our patch, and it definitely was. Thank you, Mark.
Will do, thank you.
Happy days.
Happy days.
And hello to your printer, by the way. Yes. Which sounds like it's working in overtime there.
Fabulous.
Sport in the Fields is a 94.19 independent production.
In association with Aldi UK, the official supermarket partner of Team GB.